You are listening to Secret Handshake, the podcast covering the movies that help you identify your friends and maybe make a few more along the way. Coming up, Spine number 75, Blue Velvet, and the iconic cinema of the late, great David Lynch. Featuring Deformed Babies, Carnival Freaks, Sandworms, Frank Booth, Bobby Peru, The Black Lodge, Trent Reznor, Lawnmower Men, The Cowboy, Human-Sized Rabbits, and the GOAT, Laura Dern. Martin.
Yes.
Heineken. Fuck that shit. Pabst Blue Ribbon!
Tips, like the flickering of lights. You've got their bright ideas, but we've got bigger fish to fry. Found you out there on your doorstep, undressed to the nines. From your Sunday best, black and blue velvet dress, your head's a mess and so is mine. Oh Dorothy, I'm coming home, I hope you're waiting there. I know times have been tough on you, it's all downhill from here. Oh Dorothy, inside that dreadful place deep in your heart, it's beckoning, I'm racing to your door, it's Dorothy.
Welcome back to another edition of Secret Handshake. I'm your host, Jacob Knight, and joining me as always is Martin Carlson. Martin, all our heroes keep dying this year.
It's rough.
And it feels like 2025 is kind of coming for us all. But we're here to celebrate the life and work of David Lynch. We're probably one of roughly 9,000 podcasts doing the same thing. But we're going to use Blue Velvet. It's basically our main focus because I think, and I don't want to speak for you, but I think we agree that it's his defining masterpiece. Is that correct?
Yeah, and you and I talked a lot. We've talked about him a lot over the years.
Yeah, just in general.
Just, yeah. And I remember the point you made, and I completely agree with, is you have this filmmaker, you've compared him to Fincher coming off of Alien 3 and doing Seven. Like, kind of like, well, I'm going all in. I'm going to do my thing. And he comes off this tumultuous shoot, getting basically the movie stolen from him with the Dino De Laurentiis with Dune, a complete disaster for him career wise and I think emotionally too. And he comes out with what became like the Lynch style that continued for the rest of his career. Like you had the early elements with, you know, definitely with obviously Eraserhead that continue, but that small town that kind of bled into Twin Peaks.
Yeah.
The Frank Booth character is very similar to Bobby Peru. It's kind of like you use the term a lot, Rosetta Stone, for like the other films. Is that fair?
Well, for me, Blue Velvet is almost like, I believe when because I just watched all of his movies, Drafthouse just did a retrospective, and I watched the majority of his filmography on the big screen. And Blue Velvet was the first one that I went to because they played them out of order for whatever reason. But I distinctly recall thinking while sitting in the theater that Blue Velvet is more or less the original Twin Peaks pilot.
Oh, yeah, totally.
And like how David Lynch kind of emerged from the afterbirth of this failure with Dune, fully formed.
Yes.
And the thing that's crazy, though, too, is that he had two of his defining films occur before Dune, with Eraserhead, which is one of the ultimate, you know, right next to, like, El Topo and stuff, yeah, as one of the ultimate, like, midnight movies, and that's really what absolutely he made his name on. And then, you know, he makes Elephant Man, which you had never seen before in full before?
No, I'd seen it when I was younger. Okay. It had been, it's actually one of my parents' favorite movies. Just like, they don't watch it a lot, but they were like,
"How could
see
you?"
This.
It's such an emotional like suck on you by the end. It's so heartbreaking and tough to sit through by the end.
Well, and I think watching it, I think I was just pretty fucked up about him passing too. I know you were, and I was watching it, and the word that came to my mind, that I know it came to your mind with other characters in his films, was empathy. You know, the film is so, I'm getting chills talking about it. The movie, I hadn't seen it probably in 25 years, and it just, I was on my couch and I was like crying and I was kind of a mess, and about Lynch, but also just like, honestly, the state of the world. It was just a lot kind of just, just hanging on me, and it really moved me. And the kindness and sweetness and the performance by John Hurt is utterly mind-blowing. Like, what he's able to do, the moment where they give him, I think that the highlight for me is when they give him this present of the shaving kit, the hair and shaving kit. And it's just the beauty of this guy who's never been given a gift before. You know, just like the simplicity that Lynch, and we'll talk about it later with Straight Story, beyond the, you know, weirdness that people try to ape when they're kind of copying for a Lynchian style, is like,
well, and the violence too.
And the violence, but there's this like beating heart that I think continues of the moment. I think, you know, Fix Your Hearts or Die from, you know, Twin Peaks as well, that I hold on to. I know you have the shirt as well, of just like, he had this emotional and beautiful empathy for humanity beyond everything, you know?
Well, and if you ever watch, especially in like the wake of his death, you know, a million videos emerged online of him directing actors on the set. And if you watch, there's a reason why not only he has like the same troupe of performers return time and time again and works with the same set of artists time and time again, is not only did he develop, you know, a shorthand and a comfort with them, but if you watch him interact with them, he's incredibly gentle as like a person.
Yeah.
And like, there's that great video that like is mind blowing of the first time he saw Cheryl Lee emerge as Laura Palmer on the set of Twin Peaks, The Return, and how it like, you can literally see in this older man now who's in his 70s, how it kind of just took his breath away, but it wasn't because it was his. It was like total adoration and affection for her as a person. And like
their relationship.
Yeah. And that carries through in how he crafts these characters and gets these performances from people, because like John Hurt is, he's so childlike in the way that he plays Merrick.
Yeah.
And you know, the way that he interacts with Anthony Hopkins, and obviously like, you know, some people didn't take to David Lynch, like Anthony Hopkins famously didn't like making Elephant Man.
And he's great in it.
And he's tremendous in it. It's one of the great performances of like, I guess what we consider like young Anthony Hopkins's career. But like, he just, I guess, didn't really get it.
Yeah.
You know, but the people who did get it and did get on Lynch's wavelength,
Mel Brooks,
that's what I was going to get to too. But like, people like Kyle MacLachlan, who came back and played iconic character after iconic character time and time again. And also just think of like the people that he basically helped deliver to us. Like, has Naomi Watts ever been as good as she is in Mulholland Drive?
No, I mean, like, she had her years of like 21 Grams where she was doing her super serious stuff, and she's great. But that movie is, talk about an arrival of a character.
Well, that's what
I mean. She'd been around for a while, like struggling.
Oh, yeah.
You know, to like make it happen.
But think about that performance, and also like how difficult of a performance that movie like demanded of her.
Playing three or four characters, basically. Yeah.
She goes from playing Betty to Diane by the end. And like, there again, not to keep, I'm probably going to reference these behind the scenes videos that you can dig up on Twitter and everything. But there's that amazing moment where they show her acting in the dinner table scene that's in the last 20 minutes of the movie, when, you know, Justin Theroux and Laura Herring announced their engagement, and the way she's so like caught up in rage and jealousy, and she stares at them like across the table. They showed the behind the scenes of it and the way that she acted, like the entire set fell silent. And then when David Lynch yells cut, they all like freak out because like nobody could believe that she was able to conjure like such intense feelings of hatred there. But like in order to do something like that, the director has to create an environment where they feel comfortable connecting to that character.
Yeah. And a lot of his films have really rough subject material for women in particular, and sexual violence and some pretty wild stuff.
Well, I mean, and we can get right into it with Blue Velvet. I mean, Isabella Rossellini, who was his partner at the time, this is one of the great screen performances of all time.
Yeah.
But it's also one of the most difficult performances I think I've ever seen. Like, my big thing with Lynch is Lynch is the director, the filmmaker, the artist that, like, the more I thought about it while revisiting all of these films after he died, is he is the director who's, like, as much as I love Michael Mann and David Cronenberg and everything, like, Lynch was the one who like unlocked watching movies as like art for me.
Yeah.
He was like the defining director of my lifetime because I could pinpoint and track my, like, for lack of a better term, kind of intellectual development of watching movies and studying movies through his films. And Blue Velvet was my introduction to him because I remember renting it from the video store and being so affected by it that I didn't think that I was watching, like, I should be allowed to watch it at the age that I did. Like, I was 12 or 13. Like, I felt like I was watching something illicit and kind of dangerous. And most of that came from how literally naked, but emotionally naked, Rossellini's performance is, and also just from how fucking ferocious and terrifying Dennis Hopper is in the movie. But I mean, like, there's also the infamous story about and review from Roger Ebert.
Oh, yeah.
To where Roger Ebert more or less accused David Lynch in his initial Blue Velvet review of like mental abuse because he was so fucked up by watching. Like, he says it in the review that like it's a great performance, but like to what lengths more or less did you have to go, and was that ethical, and was like David Lynch actually abusing her by eliciting something this like terrifying, frankly? And like, A, that's fucking bullshit.
Yeah.
Like,
that's like, it's like the Cannibal Holocaust thing, but a different, you know, that was a little different, but still.
Well, it's weird. It's almost like the early version of like what we see on Twitter now, to where, you know,
like a Nora or whatever.
Well, not only that, it's like there's that whole generation of people now. I don't know if it's Gen Z or however we define it. You might even be younger than that. Is that it's like, you know, the people who talk about they don't like watching sex scenes because they feel like consent can't be given by the performers to the viewer, and that it's almost like peeping on people. And you're like, well, first of all, they're playing characters. They made a movie. It's not real. And everybody got paid and they consented to like doing these scenes together. Like, you're supposed to watch it. They did it with the intention of you watching it. So that whole rationale is fucking stupid.
Because it applies across the movie, right? You're watching the rest of the movie.
Exactly.
Why is there a line with sexual nature?
It's like they can't give you as the viewer consent. But I mean, like, that's Ebert kind of did like the nascent version of that argument of being like, well, can a performer consent to their director and when they're basically playing a character that's not their creation, and like, are they more or less being manipulated into giving this performance? And it's like, yes, they did consent. They're getting paid, and like, it's their art too. It's not just Lynch's art. This is Isabella Rossellini's art. And also, like, They were together
yeah.
at the time. They were literal, like, romantic partners. So, like, were they married at the time?
I don't think they were ever married, because I know yeah. that they were together through Wild at Heart, and it was right. after that, because she said that he destroyed her when he broke up with her, because right. I believe he broke it off, and it was like they had a cosmic connection, artistic, and
yeah.
you know, and I will think it's a jumping off point from what you're talking about, that, and I don't know if it's just like a little too thorny to talk about, but like a lot of women I know do not like this movie, and who are like I just think it's too violent toward women, in a similar vein to what you're talking about with Ebert, and I kind of always be like, cool, you know what I mean? I don't engage, and I kind of don't know if it's my place to say anything, but I also find the movie, and again, this is from a male cisgender perspective, sure. but that he's going after something similar that we've talked about with the whore and the Madonna, right? A little bit that he does with Laura Palmer, right? You'd mentioned off, that's a super thunder idea of like Laura Palmer is combined those two characters.
Yeah,
you have the dark and the
she's
light.
She's the Laura Dern character and the Isabella Rossellini character rolled into one. Well, that was exactly where I was going to go with it. So you actually opened the door for this.
Yeah.
that it's kind of the defining theme or fascination of his career
yeah.
is violence against women, and not just violence against women, but the evil that essentially lives inside of men and allows them to perpetrate violence against women and also violence against other people. But I mean, like Bob in Twin Peaks and Fire Walk With Me is the literal representation of male evil.
Yeah.
And that's what Lynch, but that's also why to me, Blue Velvet has always been the original Twin Peaks pilot in my mind, is because like Frank Booth is the dry run for Leland Palmer, for Bob.
Yeah.
There's just no Bob. There's no supernatural element.
It's the guy.
To Blue Velvet. He's just a guy who has had some trauma in his life and has now become a monster. But like, to go back to your original idea of like empathy, is that like one of the greatest things about Lynch that, again, I think allows him to get these performances from performers is that he has incredible empathy, not just for like the John Merricks of the world or the Laura Palmers of the world or the Agent Coopers of the world, but he has empathy for the monsters, you know? And with Frank Booth, like, you see the pain that exists inside of him in tiny moments.
Yeah.
You know, like when he watches Dorothy sing Blue Velvet, like especially in the club, and you see mm-hmm. how much
and he's rubbing that the piece
moment
of
art
yeah.
like moves him. Or when, you know, they go and visit
Ben.
Yeah, Ben.
Ooh.
Dean Stockwell's character. In one of the strangest and most Lynchian
and scariest
of all time.
My brother, he's always like, that's the scariest scene in that movie for him. It's just like,
really?
Yeah, it is that.
Why?
Like,
does he ever explain that?
Yeah, so he and I had kind of an agreement on it. I think it's one of the scariest scenes in the movie because there is, you know, you think I was rewatching, I rewatched Superbad of all things, right?
Sure.
And it is a weird comparison, but there's that scene where they go to the party.
I'm into it.
And but when you know when you're a teenager and you're with some friends or friends of friends, you end up at a party and you pretty much realize you don't know anybody there and you feel that danger. Like that's times a million to me.
It's Michael Cera in the Coke room.
No, it's that. No, that's the exact scene where he makes him sing your eyes, these eyes, right? It's that thing of like, and I think Mottola is so interesting in that movie because he makes it kind of dark. You're like, there's a sense of violence there of like, you know, you have Martin Starr who's the nicest guy
and
in
David
the world.
Krumholtz.
Yeah, yeah. And you're like, I'm going to fucking die here, right? And
but there's also that coked out kind of sweaty redheaded
yes.
guy who you're like, that's the guy who would break the bottle over your head by accident just because he like freaks out. He's like, I don't like the way he sang that.
Yeah, exactly. But I think there's that element of a lot of Blue Velvet that is a realistic element of growing up and seeking out illicit excitement. And it is illicit excitement that brings him
sure.
to this, right? And he's toying with the dark world of just like, oh, like obviously this woman, like she's this kind of
painted like a femme fatale in a way, in the noir sense, right? Meeting her and kind of being taken into her web. But that scene in particular feels, there's someone even worse than Frank. Like, Ben feels worse than Frank in a way of, like, this is the real, like, psychopath here. Like, his whole world and the makeup and the earring and the, you know, candy-colored clown they call the Sandman song is just, like, fuck.
He's gone beyond empathy. He's also, like, Bobby Peru.
True evil. He feels like true evil. Yeah.
Is that, because sometimes Lynch, we were talking about this off mic before we started recording, is that, like, the difference between, like, Frank Booth and Blue Velvet and Bobby Peru, Willem Dafoe's nightmare of a character in Wild at Heart, God, is that there is no empathy for Bobby Peru.
No.
Bobby Peru's just disgusting. And he is a lot like Ben, now that you bring it up, is because, like, even that first or I think second scene that you get with Bobby Peru and Wild at Heart is when he tries to rape Laura Dern.
Yeah.
And it's just such an uncomfortable, icky scene. But with, to your point with Ben, and especially those kind of, like, weird, drugged out,
overweight women in
overweight
the back.
Yeah. Women, like, you wonder what kind of assault or debasement he's put them through, you know, in the name of his own pleasure. And again, like, these are characters that are so far gone that they're beyond empathy at
yes.
this point. They're
yeah.
like the demons that lurk in the shadows. They're the ones who, like, if we were to take it back to Twin Peaks and Bob, like, they're probably inhabited by Bob completely. Like, that's,
yeah.
they're vessels for like, male darkness.
Well, there's all, you know, we know Lynch also, like, likes fairy tales, and he likes the kind of mythic storytelling. Yeah. And, like, Ben, but he's the one keeping her kid and her husband.
Right.
Right, in the other room, which you don't see when you go to Ben's house. So, for me, it's like, he's this, like, fairy tale monster. Like, he's the one holding your loved ones.
He's almost like the Wicked Witch in, like, Hansel and Gretel.
Exactly what I was getting. I think that's exactly what I was thinking, you know, and he's just pure.
Yeah.
He's pure, and he's archetypal, too, which I think Lynch is very...
He's very into.
Very into as well.
Because that's the thing that we, you know, as much as we talk about and will over the course of this podcast and other people have dissected at length, is that for as much as Lynch was, like, a gateway drug into almost avant-garde yeah. cinema for so many people like us in our age and, like, who grew up in the suburbs and may not have had access to art theaters readily and
yeah.
everything. Like, they were...
Or avant-garde art of any kind.
That's
you
what
know,
I mean.
Like city.
Watching Eraserhead on, like, bootleg VHS mm-hmm. tapes or renting Blue Velvet at your local mom-and-pop video shop. Like, that, those were doorways to a type of filmmaking that you otherwise probably didn't know existed
yeah.
in the first place. But at the same time, what makes Lynch so accessible is the fact that, like, in his heart of hearts, he's a pulp storyteller.
Yes.
Like, Blue Velvet... One of the coolest things that I think about that movie, and one of the things that's, like, influenced me the most through my own, like, trying to write and create my own stories and everything, is that, like, it's a Hardy Boys mystery. If you watch
yeah.
it with any kind of, like, you know, objectivity whatsoever, is that, like, Jeffrey Beaumont coming home from college to take care of his sick dad, he stumbles upon a mystery the
yeah.
same way the Hardy Boys would in any one of those, like, 110-page books that you read when you were a kid, you know, and he teams up with Sandy, you know, the local cute girl from the high school, and they just go on an adventure together. They become, you know, the mystery machine. And they want to solve the riddle of this severed ear that Jeffrey finds in a field. And it helps that, you know, Sandy's dad is a local police detective.
Yeah.
And
it's all very conveniently put together.
Them,
yeah.
Exactly. It's constructed in the same way that if you saw this in the hands of a more conventional filmmaker, it would still exist. It just wouldn't exist without all of the Lynch flourishes that make it distinctly idiosyncratic in his own work.
Yeah, and I mean, I totally agree because it connects it to, obviously, to Mulholland Drive. It's a very similar setup, right, of the person, this person who wants to live inside the story, right? You have
right.
Jeffrey who's like looking for some excitement, obviously that becomes sexual excitement, but for Naomi Watts's character, it's like, oh, I'm in Hollywood, everything's so amazing, and I'm involved in a mystery. And they're so they're so childish about it at first. It's like, baby, you're Diane. It feels completely safe and like this is pretend, right? This is all pretend. It's not, or it's not gonna be, we're not in any real danger, right? At that moment.
Well, it all comes from his sort of like 50s Americana
totally.
Brain, too. Yeah. Is that like, you know, the big thing when Blue Velvet originally came out in the mid 80s? It's 84, right? 85. Yeah, oh, yeah. Dune is 84, so this is 85, which is incredible that he was able to pump this out as quickly as he could.
There's a quick shoot, I believe, too. I remember they really just like did
it. Well, it's a pretty low budget movie, mm-hmm. you know, for the time, but like, you know, the famous sequence is the intro, you know, set to She Wore Blue Velvet. And it's like, you know, the fire truck waving, like cruising past, and the white picket fence and the roses. And like, you're in this. It is Lumberton is Twin Peaks.
Yeah.
You know,
it's
the original version of Twin Peaks. It's this idyllic, tucked away, you know, version of American suburbia that Jeffrey then finds the dark side to, you know. But like, the crazy thing watching it is that like all of his collaborators come on this. Like, there's never an Angelo Badalamenti score for David Lynch before Blue Velvet.
Yeah.
And then he scores pretty much all of his movies after this, mm-hmm. you know, the visual palette that he, you know,
the saturated,
that hyper saturated, and also the transition from light to dark. Like, he does that in all of his movies pretty much going forward, especially the Hitchcockian kind of influence films, Blue Velvet, Mulholland Drive, Lost Highway.
Yes.
Lost Highway is almost, that one is the anomaly to a certain degree, because we watched that together
on the big screen.
And the one thing I distinctly remember thinking is that there is no light in Lost Highway. Like, there's scenes that take place in the daytime, but that doesn't make them light. They're not light in the same way that like there's light in Twin Peaks
or Betty getting to LA.
Yeah.
You know,
everything is kind of tinged by darkness and sadness and violence in Lost Highway in a way that I think makes that movie a little less accessible.
It's angry. It's an angry movie.
It's a very angry movie. Yeah. And it also comes, I mean, his main influence for that film being the O.J. Simpson trial.
Yeah.
It comes from a very angry, ugly time in American history that he was obsessed with.
Well, and you bring on Trent Reznor, right? You bring on who's an angry musician. He was all, curious to your point, like, he's also one of the best person for spotting talent and spotting good collaborators.
Yeah.
And I don't think he ever worked with Reznor again, but like that style, and like, you not to go, we can talk real quick about Lost Highway, and I know that I'm a bigger fan than you are, and part of that is because I saw that with my brother. We rented it from the video store. One of the first Lynch movies I remember watching was that. And just being like, it feels like such a microcosm of 1996 to me, of like that style that was just, you know, that kind of Nine Inch Nails style that was kind of, you know, leaking out into the rest of culture. And
well, I mean,
that like the return
curated
of the kind of like rockabilly style that was like popping back up as well, you know.
Well, Baltazar Getty's whole thing,
his whole shtick,
it felt like half the guys in LA looked like that.
Yeah,
you know?
Totally.
Like that greaser, like, I work in a mechanic shop, but like still can afford these fucking $400 jeans look.
But it's weirdly a Bruce Springsteen world. You know, I think of like the I'm on Fire video that John Sayles made, like that mechanic shop sexual, you know, thing.
Well, and the other thing is he and Reznor form this bond throughout the years too. They do work together again right up all the way through the return.
Oh, right.
To where is that episode 8? That is the atomic bomb episode that opens with Nine Inch Nails as she's gone away, right?
Yeah,
he
I think so.
He comes and they have that amazing Roadhouse intro for Twin Peaks The Return where the guy comes on stage and says, "The Nine Inch Nails." And then it's Reznor just fucking ripping through that song. And it's incredible. But that's also a weird shift where, you know, we always associate musically people like Badalamenti or Julie Cruz with that very dreamy, synth-driven aesthetic that defines
a lot of strings,
David Lynch's cinema. Very, like, you fall into it. Like, the dreams that he's not only using as inspiration, but is conjuring on screen. Like, Lost Highway is a pivot point to where that movie and Twin Peaks The Return are interesting in terms of the conversation that they have with each other. And that, you know, Mulholland Drive is more of like a conventional, like, Badalamenti score.
Yeah. Very romantic.
Very romantic, very lush, very foreboding at certain times. Like that amazing synth track as the limo goes up the side of the canyon and everything. And it just looks fucking incredible. It's just luring you into that world from like the opening frames of that movie. Also, I mean, like, if we're going to be real, that's the only film for me personally that vies for the title of Lynch's best movie, like his true masterpiece. But with Lost Highway, it's the first time that you ever get, and we've talked about this in the past too, in that it's a very distinctly, to your point, like 90s thing.
Yeah.
Is that the Lost Highway CD? Like, I had that.
I still have it.
I played the shit out of that all the time, but it was during the time of the curated soundtrack.
Yeah, Rammstein is on there.
And like, it is a snapshot of, like, industrial music, what people were into, you know, in the mid-90s, right down to, you know, Nine Inch Nails writing The Perfect Drug for that soundtrack, and it's still incredible.
Dude, Smashing Pumpkins. Smashing Pumpkins hits. Like, these are all, like, hits of theirs. It's not just, like, a one-off song on there. It's like, fuck.
Well, and Twin Peaks The Return feels like him reviving that thing of, like, there's that huge portion of it with the Roadhouse performances.
Yeah, the Chromatics show up.
Oh, my God, dude. That moment.
I was like, I thought the Chromatics when I was watching it. It just, like, stopped me.
So we're going to talk about moments in my life and how, like, Lynch, like, has marked them. Is I'll never forget watching, is it the first two episodes of Twin Peaks, when they premiered on Showtime, is we actually had a party at Scott Wampler's house, and everybody who was invited was required to bring a pie. We all, and it was one table in his kitchen to where everybody brought their own pie. I brought a peach one from Quack's Bakery here in town. And I'll never forget, Scott was shit-faced drunk by the time that started. And we all gather around the television, and a couple people were talking. And he just goes, "Shut the fuck up!" Like, in the middle of the house, and you just... And then for the rest of the time that we were watching The Return, those first couple episodes, it was just
silent,
dead silent.
Yeah.
And everybody completely sucked into what we were experiencing together in a way that, like, outside of a movie theater, I'd never actually seen before, except for the moment the Chromatics came on. And that scene where James comes back, James has always been cool, you know, and the Chromatics start playing, and you could literally feel, like, the feelings welling up in people's throats, just because, like, not only is Lynch, like, an incredible talent with, like, his original collaborators, he just has great taste, and he pinpoints these songs that are able to evoke the emotion that he wants you to feel perfectly. And like Shadow by Chromatics in that moment is so incredible. And like, it's mind blowing. And then the fact that he's able to continue that throughout the run of Twin Peaks, The Return, which like, to take it back to like Lynch's, how we were talking about how he's accessible. One of the things that made Twin Peaks such a hit, a lot like Blue Velvet, is that like, he knew how to craft a soap opera. He knew how to craft a mystery, like one of the first maybe mystery boxes in all television history outside of like, you know, Who Shot J.R.
I was going to say
like
Dallas is the other one,
But this is more because the entire thing was a mystery box. It wasn't a cliffhanger. It was closer to like something like, you know, what J.J. Abrams and Damon Lindelof
like Lost. Famous
for with Lost, is that you're always constantly asking that question of like, and it's all built around, I mean, I have a t-shirt with the original promo on it. It says, "Who killed Laura Palmer?" That was the question. And then what ruined the show was when the network made him halfway through season two reveal that it was Leland Palmer the entire time. Because I think the original conceit was going to be he's just building this melodrama around a mystery that may never actually be solved throughout the entire runtime of Twin Peaks. And then you get to Twin Peaks, The Return, and it's so, for as excited as everybody was to return to that world and have Lynch do this, what was it?
18 episode,
basically 18-hour David Lynch movie, more or less.
Yeah.
And it's uncut, unfiltered Lynch. The question was always going into that, how much of this is going to be like the original network series?
Yeah. With and pie and coffee and
was going to be, because you're in the time of like the revival and homage and like the reboot quill and everything and like that were, there was also that danger of like, does anybody give a fuck about Twin Peaks, The Return, almost you know, like 30 years later, you know? And then you actually watched it and it was the other side of Lynch. Because it's like you watch the original Twin Peaks and like you have the surrealist flourishes and Bob and like the Black Lodge and all that stuff too, where The Return is like, it's just almost like any creative impulse he had, he followed. And it's more avant-garde than it is accessible.
Yeah. Well, I remember a lot of people were kind of like, where's the pie and coffee, right? They wanted, Dougie in particular felt like a slap in the face because it was like, where's Agent Cooper? I'm watching this guy.
He doesn't show up till the next to last episode.
Exactly. Basically. So he was, it felt very perverse in that way because he's like, I'm not going to give you the thing you're here for. You know,
which is kind of what Twin Peaks was all about after Fire Walk With Me, too.
Yeah, yeah.
Is because Fire Walk With Me was such a deliberate middle finger after, it's ABC, right?
I think it was ABC or CBS.
No, it's ABC.
Okay.
Where they played Twin Peaks, is that after he basically had his baby, you know, taken from him again, he went and got French money from overseas, made Twin Peaks, Fire Walk With Me, and then like the opening shot is literally somebody smashing a television with a sledgehammer, a woman screaming off like off screen, and then him denying you any kind of answer from like, because you know Twin Peaks famously ends with season two with Agent Cooper stuck in the Black Lodge.
Yeah,
you know. And Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me deliberately is like, fuck you. I'm not going to tell you anything. Instead, what I'm going to give you is the most harrowing portrait of a victim of sexual assault ever put to screen. Like, I think Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me, in depicting the last days of Laura Palmer, is one of the great horror films in American history that doubles as like, probably the greatest cinematic fuck you to like its own fan base.
What's also Lynch like you again with like Lost Highway, it's a very angry movie just generally, right? About the extratextual, how it's taken away from it, but also just the story itself of really showing Laura Palmer for more than you ever got of her in the show, right? You're like getting a lot of time and also letting Cheryl Lee really do her thing.
Well, and that's what he always said was the inspiration from it, is that he was always mad that Laura Palmer became less of a person and more of an object inside of the actual show. And he was obsessed with her, and that he wanted to actually bring her to life and have people feel her pain, and like, because he carried around inside of his head with like this creation that he had that was rattling around that he felt like he never actually did justice to, if that makes sense. And I think that's also what makes the movie so tragic, is that, to your point, like Cheryl Lee in Fire Walk With Me is like, that's one of the great, I mean, along with Isabella Rossellini, like the way he's able to get these
Naomi Watts and Mulholland Drive
from actresses is like, it's uncanny, man, because she's so incredible in it, and like, it's so heartbreaking, and it's like, it's actually tough to watch, because when this one played, so I've seen this in theaters 3 times. All of them are incredibly uncomfortable viewings, because I don't think that this is a movie that you should, it's tough to watch with strangers because it elicits such intense feelings out of me. Is that the first time I saw it was on 35 millimeter at the Ritz, because it was back when they did a full Lynch retrospective as one of those crazy programming things that they used to do
days
at the Draft House Ritz, where if you bought, I think the badge was like $60. If you bought a badge to it, you got to entrance into every movie, and everything was done in 35. So I saw every David Lynch movie in 35 millimeter projected on the big screen, including they did a marathon. Now this was digital because there's no prints of it. They actually did a marathon of Twin Peaks at Lakeline, where it was a nonstop marathon, a lot like the Exhumed Films one, where you watched both seasons all the way through with basically no break.
Hell yeah.
I lasted all the way up till the Leland Palmer reveal.
It was a good time to leave.
I was like, all right, time to go.
Yeah. You know? Before Heather Graham shows up. Yeah.
But like, watching it on 35 millimeter, Firewalk With Me, that is, for the first time, was like almost like a religious experience, because that was another one that I watched on VHS a million times as a kid. Like, I didn't even know Twin Peaks was a show when I first rented Firewalk With Me. I just thought this was a David Lynch movie. Well, I guess I knew it was a show because it was my grandmother's favorite show. So I knew of the existence of Twin Peaks, but I'd never actually seen it because it was back in the day when
there's no internet.
There's no internet. There's no streaming. And Twin Peaks was actually kind of hard to see after it didn't air anymore, because there was like some VHS tapes and stuff, but like they were kind of hard to find. Like, not everybody had them. So I'd never actually seen the show itself. So I watched Firewalk With Me, and like, the only thing I had trouble with, which I think everybody still has trouble with, is the first 20 minutes that actually do have Agent Cooper and David Bowie showing up and disappearing. And, you know, all the stuff with Chris Isaac and Kiefer Sutherland, which Kiefer Sutherland's fucking awesome.
I like him in this line. That weird.
And also, like, David Lynch as Gordon Cole. Great stuff, man.
Yep.
Just screaming about, you know, blue roses and you have Lil, our girl Lil, coming out and doing like all of the interpretive dance for them to figure out the, you know, the clues to. But I mean, I remember watching that even as like a 14 or 15 year old kid and being like, I don't know what's happening here. But as soon as it transitioned to Twin Peaks and the last days of Laura Palmer, I got it instantly, because it reminded me of Halloween. For me, it becomes David Lynch's Halloween.
Well, because it's he, like Carpenter and like Stephen King, like, knows how to do a small town, right? And the way it is this like innocent girl, a lot of her walking through the neighborhood like Laurie, you know.
Well, and the amazing thing too is that like that bottle of Menti theme that comes the doo doo, and then the rising and falling synths. I didn't know because I'd never seen the show that that was the Twin Peaks theme. But I remember that hitting my like 14-year-old brain like an atom bomb and being like, what is this music? This is fucking incredible.
Yeah.
And I was just hooked from that point forward. And then that movie fucked me up for life, because once you get to the end of watching Laura die, you know, and be murdered and then ascend with the angel, which is still, for my money, one of the most powerful images in the history of cinema. It's like, man, when we watched it on this last go around in the theaters, that I was so scared because I saw it at Lakeline, which for those who don't live in Austin is the very suburban North Austin draft house. And I was in there, and there was barely anybody else in the theater around me. And then I swear to God, they were on a fucking date. It was like a frat dude and his girlfriend.
Mistake.
And they were probably in their early – they had to be in their early 20s because – like probably like 21 or 22 because they ordered drinks. And they were sitting next to me, and I instantly felt my heart sink before the movie started. I'm like, oh, no. This is going to be – not only is – do I think these people are going to talk through this movie? They're going to watch me have like an emotional breakdown.
Yeah.
And be like, who's this fucking old guy next to us just crying his eyes out? But dude, they were fucking locked into this movie. Like just completely silent, reverent, like loved it. But I did like that, that final, those moments with the angel and her looking at it. And also like that last shot, that pull out, when she dies and ascends to the Black Lodge and it's Cooper touching her on the shoulder and it slowly pulls out and the light flashes on her and she's just hysterically laughing and accepting her fate is like, it's so mind blowing. Like you can't, it's hard to even put into words like how emotionally affecting that moment is.
Well, and it, you know, I remember it was Howard Hawks who said, like, have five good scenes in your script and no bad ones. Have five great scenes and no bad ones.
Yeah.
I feel like Lynch, I mean, this is a super shallow thing to say, but, like, he has just, like, beyond being a great storyteller, he just has these moments that are really just, that are for the ages.
They're transcendent.
You know, and they, yeah, transcendent's the word, because I think of this, honestly, for me, watching Blue Velvet this time, I watched it with my partner. I mean, she hadn't seen it in years, is like how much about falling in love the movie is too, right? Of understanding, of growing up and being like, you have this part of you that is seeking excitement and darkness and sexual gratification. Another part of you that, as from a male, from the male's character, another guy who wants happiness and comfort, you know, and it's that being that tearing. And I think that scene of them, for me, the Julie Cruz song and them dancing and kissing for the first time.
Oh my God. In the basement?
Is in the way, the sound design and everything, and just having that come forward is such a beautiful moment.
Isn't this name of the song The Voice of Love?
Yeah. Or it's called Falling, right? No, Falling is Twin Peaks. Sorry,
Voice of Love, again, to make it the original Twin Peaks pilot, is like you have Julie Cruz doing the love theme.
Yes, and it's so like, but then you go right from that scene to the naked scene with
Isabella,
because he takes her home, and you have that moment again from Jeffrey's perspective of, here is the fear that everyone has, I think, when they fall in love, of, oh my, this person's going to find out a piece of shit I am, or everything I've ever done bad in my life, and it's just right there, like the evidence of the darkness that he's been playing with, and you know, and it just, it's so in your face.
Well, and think about even what Rossellini, her character, says to Jeffrey in that moment is, he put his disease in me.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's one of the central, you know, theses of like Lynch's entire career, again, is that it's like men carry this evil with them that they can infect you with, whether they want to or care to or even have knowledge of, you know, like Jeffrey's not a bad person in any way, but he's a human being. And again, this comes back to your original point of like empathy, is that like, he isn't mature enough to know yet that he carries this innate evil inside of him, because like, and I think that is represented by the allure of the dark side.
Yeah.
And like the, and it's to take it back again to your point of like how Lynch is like an archetypal storyteller, is that it's honestly, again, to, I guess I'll counter your super bad weird comparison, is that it's no different than like Star Wars, and that, you know, Lucas, you know, has the Force and you have the dark side, and you either choose light or you choose dark. And like, there's a temptation to the dark side that even calls like the purest, most powerful Jedi in the galaxy and Anakin Skywalker. To me, there, it's no different in how Lynch represents human evil inside of men, is that it's like you're just drawn to these things, whether you are self-aware of it or not. And that's where the disease comes from, is that it's like you can infect the other people around you, especially women. And like in Lynch's eyes, like there's that incredible shot where Sandy emerges from the darkness for the first time.
Top five greatest shot he ever did. That's and like, the music, the Battle Lamenti.
The Battle Lamenti, like strings that come up. It's just, it's so breathtaking.
It's like, but Hitchcock also, fucks Cirque or something. It's just so good.
Yeah, it's crazy. Yeah. And it does have that almost like tongue-in-cheek vibe that like Douglas Sirk's like best, you know, Technicolor dreams and melodramas ever had. But at the same time, it's like Jeffrey, you know, Sandy, she also has the dream of the Robins and everything.
Yeah.
And how she narrates these dreams to him, and how inside of them, it's almost like to Lynch, like all human goodness and like hope for the future resides inside of women. And like men are just there to basically corrupt that in one way or the other, because she becomes such a calming and inspiring figure to him that he keeps coming back to. Like Sandy is more or less like Jeffrey's life preserver in this sea of like darkness that he keeps trying to cling to. And she wants to save him, while also acknowledging that like when she finds out about Dorothy and she stumbles in naked and torn up and talking about Jeffrey, like put his disease inside her. Is that the first time we ever get the Laura Dern face?
Yeah. The cry face.
The
yeah.
cry face where she's like this isn't obviously a visual medium, but everybody who's seen this knows what fucking face she's making, where she's like, ah, and you're like, oh no. But it's almost like all men are waiting to disappoint women in Lynch's worlds. And like, that's the first time we see Sandy actually be completely corrupted by this boy that she thought was just as pure and good as she was.
Well, and it, you know, it's something back to the archetypal thing too. Something I know frustrates me as a Lynch fan, and is how a lot of people watch it in a midnight movie mentality of laughing.
Oh, you
know?
Yeah.
And so I know we don't have to harp on this too long, but I went to see Blue Velvet on 35 and when I lived in Atlanta. It was also when I was trying to break up with this horrible woman, and I hope she's listening. She sucks so bad, and she almost ruined my view of this movie, because she came up. She goes, "Why won't you call me back?" I said, "Because I don't really like you anymore."
Did she make the Sandy face?
She was too evil for that. Sorry, but it was just terrible. And I was like, she almost ruined my experience, but it didn't. The person who ruined my experience were the moment where Sandy tells a story about the Robins in the car, and she's just owning that scene. Just amazing, right? And people are laughing. You know, and then you have the line, the very sincere line from Kyle MacLachlan, why is there so much badness in the world? Why are there people like Frank?
Yeah.
Right. And what I always think about is people who talk about Lynch before, but especially after he passed, of there wasn't a cynical bone in that guy's body. He was a sincere person. And they said that he believed in the beauty and the goodness of a cup of coffee and a good slice of pie. Like, that's Lynch for real. And he meant...
That's why Bob's Big Boy was his favorite restaurant.
No, but it's like he believed in that true thing. And that scene is just... That's
you know, Jeffrey saying what he means and her saying the story of the Robins is like, it's archetypal and it's beautiful, but people are like, oh, he's joking around. It's like, no, he's not fucking joking around.
Well, here's the thing. The only place I agree with you.
Yeah.
Like, I hate anybody and they should be thrown in the gulag if you laugh during Blue Velvet. But at the same time, I will say to take it back to the original point of Lynch being kind of a gateway drug into like avant-garde cinema is that it did take me a moment as a kid. And even moving forward, I mean, Wild at Heart is another great example of this with Nick Cage's whole kind of mega performance inside of that movie as Sailor Ripley, is that like Lynch also has a very stylized way of directing actors.
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, Mulholland Drive is another one. The whole like dream sequence or really like first 90 minutes of that movie.
Her kind of quote unquote bad acting in a way, like purposeful. It's, first time I saw it, I said, why does she suck so bad?
It's all very stilted, but in a purposeful way. And like you reference like Douglas Sirk, there is like a kitsch value to it to where it's purposeful. But again, it fits with like the light to dark kind of transition is that in the light, everybody's happy and smiling and gee golly, it's kind of saccharine. Exactly. They exist in the Cirque world. But then as you notice, as you get more and darker and darker and darker, the acting style changes. It becomes more naturalistic. They feel more like human beings again, because they don't have to put part of it to, in my view, is like that veneer of being cordial and having to put on that smiling face, whether you're at the hardware store working or like, you know, you're interacting with your grandma or you're going to the corner drugstore and seeing the guy who works there or the soda jerk or whatever. It's all part of like Lynch's idea. And this is all a facade. And beneath it, there's the ants. There's the bugs.
Yeah, the roaches, or the beetles.
The horrible
beetles,
like, killing each other and stuff and, like, feasting on, you know, the underbelly. And, like, but Mulholland Drive is the same way, too, because as soon as you transition out of Betty's dream and into Diane's
reality,
like, the acting style is different.
Oh, yeah.
It's
for
like,
everybody.
For everybody.
Yeah.
Everything changes. And it is. It's his acknowledgement that, you know, outside of these kind of perfectly manicured kind of realities we create for ourselves, we're completely different people. Do you think that's why? I know that you're not huge on this movie, and I enjoy it more than you do, but even admit to having some issues with sitting through it, frankly, is Inland Empire.
Yeah.
Do you think that's why some people are resistant towards it, because it's so abrasive, so purposefully ugly, and frankly, like, it's almost all darkness the entire time. There's no light. I think Lost Highway is pretty similar, too, but Lost Highway at least is like hyper stylized, has the video cameraman, has a lot of like signposts from like other Lynch stuff that you've seen before.
You're getting that itch scratched, right?
Yeah. Like, I mean, like Robert Blake is just one of your classic Lynch monsters.
Yes.
You know, but like Inland Empire feels like one of the truest, if not the truest, one for me movies of all time, where it's just a guy with a consumer grade DV camera making art, stringing it together for basically 3 hours. And he doesn't really give a shit whether you get it or not, but it's so ugly and in your face. And there's
kind of shrill,
very shrill. Yeah. And there is no day versus night again. Like,
yeah, I think, you know, I think for me, it's just two things. It's, or a couple of things. It's back to the earlier pure avant-garde, less, narrative kind of film, right? And then you also have,
because you have the movie set stuff, which feels like an extension of Mulholland Drive.
Yeah, but it all, the most of the visual style of most of the film is that like early 2000s, like you said, DV video, which just isn't, you know, attractive as much to look at, especially in hindsight, right? You think about the beauty of Blue Velvet or of Even Wild at Heart or Mulholland Drive and the colors and the shot on a film. I just think for me, I don't enjoy watching it because, again, I don't have the signposts even of like the normal Lynch stuff that I kind of hold on to.
Yeah.
When I'm not sure what's going on. This
it's
one
a
is
pure
just,
experiment.
Exactly. And it's just like, it's not my kind of thing. I know a lot of some people find it, I mean, it's still, I know there's a lot going on in it that I'm not picking up on. So I would never be like, this is a bad movie. I think it's still a masterful avant-garde film, but it's not one I like to revisit.
Which part loses you the most? The Polish prostitutes being abused or the man-sized rabbits?
I think the rabbits. I know he's got rabbit stuff in others, like his later work as well.
Yeah.
And I just like, and I think like, you know, to your earlier point about, you know, this being a gateway drug to like avant-garde is like, I kind of stop with Lynch. I don't go too much further, you know, like I've watched my fair share of, you know, Stan Brakhage and stuff like that in film school. But I do like some avant-garde like visual art, but not usually video art, which this feels like.
You're not firing up some like vintage Warhol on like a Friday night.
Yeah, I'm not watching Empire State or Haircut. You know, it's just not not my vibe.
Think we should get to questions?
Let's do it.
All right. Questions about Blue Velvet and the cinema of David Lynch. Martin, top five Lynch.
Go. So number five, I'm going to do Lost Highway. Personally, it's one of the first I saw. I have a lot of kind of connection to it. I wouldn't say it's like one of his best, but it's one I actually enjoy watching. Like you said, it's one of the darker ones. I like that world.
It's the darkest one.
Yeah, yeah. And I like the whole...
maybe Inland Empire, but I get, yeah.
But the whole aesthetic, too, of, like, the jazz clubs and just, like, the shot. Also, like, the kind of Hot Rods thing, which you know I like. It has that, like, greaser thing.
And you ride hard for Balthazar Getty in that movie.
I love him.
You actually really like him. He's one of my main sticking points is I don't think he's that great as an actor. But, like,
I think he's just
it's a vibe, man.
He's got a look. He's got a really... And when he brings it to The Return as well... Very beautiful man, you know.
And I mean, we also haven't even brought up Bill Pullman, who's fucking incredible, just rocking that jazz saxophone the entire time.
At his most stilted, too.
Yeah,
you know.
Well, I think he's great in it.
No, I like him, but I think he's doing like Lynch is knowing how to use him correctly,
right?
Because he has kind of a stilted way he delivers in other films, and it works.
And
I think
does
for this character,
the whole disaffected. Like gravelly thing, but I've always dug Bill Pullman as an actor. I just think he's a cool fucking guy.
I always like Zero Effect.
Oh my god, that was gonna be the one I was gonna bring up. It's so good. I mean, he's also one of the best cinematic presidents ever in Independence.
Oh
Day.
Yeah.
I mean, he has a real presence to him. I mean, and Patricia Arquette in that is like, good lord.
Oh yeah,
She's just the Vertigo blonde of all Vertigo blondes.
When again, him really playing with like, he said Vertigo, like you have the dark hair and then the blonde hair, the two different worlds. And yeah. Number four, I would do Straight Story, which we haven't talked too much about. Rewatched it.
Great fucking movie.
It's mind blowing. Like it's, I remember my dad would always make this point, which is completely incorrect. but he would be
hi,
like,
Dave.
Yeah, hi Dave. And he would be like, this is him apologizing for his darker films. And I was like, Dad, shut the fuck up. You don't know what you're talking about.
Wasn't it mainly him just taking a job? Because he wasn't like...
it was Disney. It's a Disney movie.
He wasn't that as successful for a long time after Fire Walk With Me. I mean, even Lost Highway famously had the two thumbs down used as like a promo from Siskel and Ebert for Lost Highway. I mean, like, there was a time where, like, that's the thing that a lot of people fucking forget, especially in the 90s, is that Lynch fell out of favor.
Yeah.
There was a period of time where, like, people were like, he fucking lost it, man. Especially after Firewalk. I mean, there's the infamous Tarantino quote where he was like, I gave up on David Lynch after Firewalk With Me, because that's when he crawled up his own ass completely. Like, which is completely incorrect. And I mean, Tarantino has an entire book filled with, like, weird opinions that you can read.
Yeah.
So, like, we went and saw him talk about it in person.
Kind of.
In one of the worst presentations ever that we've podcasted about in the past. But, like, you know, there was a point in time where, like, Lynch wasn't this revered artist
elder statesman
anymore. Like, he was kind of a has-been. And then Mulholland Drive, I mean, again, you want to talk about a movie that completely not only revived his career completely, but, like, marked as a passage of time in my life, is that, like, there was Blue Velvet as the VHS, and Firewalk were the two big VHS ones for me. I remember Firewalk was one of those tapes, kind of like I've talked about with Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer, is that I kept it out for so long that they actually closed my account at Blockbuster because they were like, you can't pay these fees. I don't know what the fuck you're doing. Because I kept the tape and I just kept watching Firewalk.
Also a movie I watched way too much of was Henry.
Yeah, well, me too.
I love that movie so much.
Yeah, I love it too. But Mulholland Drive came out when I was a junior in high school.
Mm-hmm.
And I would drag anyone who would say yes to me. Because I remember, of all fucking things in the world, I remember the radio ads for Mulholland Drive when they would play, when I would drive my mom's Jeep Wrangler around, and I would hear them all the time. And they were like, from David Lynch. And I was like, the motherfucker who made Blue Velvet? Hell yeah, dog. He's all back. Because for me, as like a high school kid, it wasn't, like, I read film criticism all the time in like the Philadelphia Inquirer and stuff, but I wasn't like elbow deep in it like I would be after college and everything. Like, I didn't know that Lynch had fallen out of favor. He was just the cool motherfucker who made Blue Velvet and Firewalk With Me. And, like, Eraserhead and all the shit that I really liked. So it was like, oh, shit, David Lynch has a new movie. I got to go see it. And I went down to the Ritz in Center City, and I would literally drag anybody who would say yes to me. And I saw fucking Mulholland Drive 7 times in theaters.
Hell yeah.
On its initial run. I took my English teacher to see Mulholland Drive, a big gay black man named Charles Watterson, who I didn't know was gay at the time. He came out. I guess he was out, but, like, you know, his students didn't really know, you should say. But, like, at the time, I remember sitting next to him, and when that lesbian love scene kicked in, it was like, you know, kind of side-eyeing each other, like, is this okay?
I watched it with Dave Carlson.
Oh.
We rented it on DVD.
How'd that go?
It was terrible. No, he liked the movie. And it's funny, my dad likes Lynch, too.
It was horrible.
No, but he got me, I was, that signed Lynch photo my dad got me for Christmas. It's awesome, you know?
Two girls scissoring, Dave Carlson squirming uncomfortably in his chair.
It's like when I took him to a Nick Cave concert and he was wearing a sweater vest. I'm like, Dad, this isn't going to go well for you.
This doesn't really seem like your seed.
Yeah, but we went and saw, we know we were watching it at home. And he just, like, sitting there, and he's sitting there. I'm 17, I think, when we watched it. 16, same thing. And I'm sitting there, and he goes, must be very difficult for actresses to act in a scene like this. And then turns back, I go, Dad, stop talking.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's one of those moments where you're like, Dad, you didn't actually have to fill the uncomfortable silence.
Just let it, be,
just
brother.
Let it hang out there. We're both feeling things. There's some nipples.
Yeah.
And tongues, like, going places that, you know, we don't really want to talk about, so just let it happen.
Okay, so, but Straight Story, I find amazing. We're watching this time again, just a really beautiful, like, his view of, like, America is just, is gorgeous. So, like, the American goodness that is there.
Well, and also just amazing Richard Farnsworth.
Yeah, who was dying as they watched.
Dying as they made it, and then committed suicide afterwards. I mean, those final moments with Harry Dean Stanton.
Ooh, too much, man.
Again, as a name from the Lynch family, we haven't even really mentioned yet as one of his great collaborators over the years. Yeah. And, you know, Wild
and friend, and very good friend.
Very
yeah.
good friend, cigarette buddy, you know. But, like, it's also one of the great examples in Lynch's filmography is that, you know, to take it back to Dave's wrong point is that it was a Disney movie and it is viewed as one of his more straightforward, accessible films along with Elephant Man.
Yeah.
But they actually share a lot of similarities stylistically. And when you watch Elephant Man, like Elephant Man, sure, it's straightforward and it feels kind of like an awards or what we would call like a prestige drama yeah. now. But it also opens with a weird, surreal montage of a woman possibly being raped by an elephant.
Yeah.
That's like, and like the ascension sequence that concludes, you know, nothing ever dies. That moment where, like, you go up and you see his, you know, Merrick's mother's face in the cosmos and stuff. Straight Story has the same exact ending.
Yeah.
To where it ascends to heaven, more or less, of these two brothers reuniting and everything. Is like,
well, they can now die. And,
exactly. And, yeah. They can die happy. They can die, like, with peace that they've come together once again. But, like, even in his most accessible, quote unquote, straightforward films, they're still works of David Lynch art.
Yeah.
Like, it's all of his stuff is still present if you look for it.
Yeah. So that's number four. Number three, I'm going to do Wild at Heart, which used to be my number one for a long time. And I think I was just being like kind of a contrarian, like, well, actually my favorite one is Wild at Heart. And I still love it, but it's not close to number one.
Cool. There's just, I think it has all the style and the violence and like Nick Cage yeah. and the sexy Laura Dern of it all. And like, it's sweaty and nasty and has the
great
metal music.
Yeah, yep.
Like the thing that it lacks that I think that like Blue Velvet and Mulholland Drive really have in Straight Story and Elephant Man, like his truly great works is an emotional core.
Yeah.
Like it just, I never quite care, you know, about Sailor Ripley.
Well, because he does, I mean, we're talking again back to the idea of archetypes, like him basing it on Wizard of Oz. Like he's really playing with like mythic, classic cinema archetypes in this movie. So it works on that level. But again, I don't have even Laura Dern. It's a very different character, you know, versus her character in Blue Velvet, which is such the heart of that movie. Wow. I don't feel
there
that
is
here.
No real heart here.
No.
Has a great Harry Dean Stanton performance.
He's
and
so
also,
weird. Oh, yeah.
You know, Diane Ladd's completely unhinged and Oscar nominated?
I think. And their first time being
or
in film.
Win.
And their
Did
first,
she win for
I
it?
Don't think so.
I thought she won for that movie.
But it was their first time being in a film together.
Yeah.
Again, similar to that kind of like, you know, Jamie Lee Curtis with her mom in the Carpenter films too.
Yeah.
But number two would be Mulholland Drive, and then one's Blue Velvet. Elephant Man is like a dark horse to pop into top five after watching it again. It's really masterful. I mean, it fucked me up. Talk about an emotional core to a movie.
Five for me would be Elephant Man. I just think that movie's near. I mean, the top five movies I'm about to talk about in my mind are pretty much all perfect films. You know, I would go Elephant Man, Dune. No, I'm fucking with you.
I still love Dune.
Eraserhead, Twin Peaks, Fire Walk With Me. Although I lied, Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me is not a perfect movie. I think the messiness is actually what makes that movie.
Yeah.
Blue Velvet and then Mulholland Drive. Mulholland Drive for me is just an atom bomb of a film, too. And also, like, we haven't even talked about that it was his failed attempt at making another Twin Peaks.
Exactly, yeah.
You know, it was rejected by the network, and then he goes, again, gets like foreign money more or less, and shoots an entire ending and makes it into a film and makes maybe his defining masterpiece with it.
Well, again, like you said, coming off a sense of failure and then knocking it out of the park.
Yeah.
You know,
it's almost like he needs the impetus of like someone telling him he's wrong or that his art is no good, where it's like he's just like, I'm gonna fucking show you
the reaction.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sense to it.
Double feature.
So I was thinking about this. I read this article. I forget. It was like Sight and Sound years ago. And they were just talking about like how the 80s avant-garde mixed with like popular filmmaking was just like was really happening. And they bring up a lot of films that like were like very close to Blue Velvet in terms of just like taking everything by storm stylistically. But I think for me, in terms of like the dream world 80s formative film, I'm going to go Manhunter. I think that...
Shocker.
I know, but those... I mean, it's Michael Mann, but I think those pair really well together. Another one I was thinking would be like Blood Simple. Just like that early mid-80s of these directors really kind of coming into their own.
And this is with Blue Velvet?
Yeah, with Blue Velvet.
I'm going to go a different direction and say Cinematic Middle Fingers with Twin Peaks Firewalk with Me. Perhaps I can't decide if it's first, it's probably second, with the opener being Only God Forgives by Nick Reffin.
That's a real...
It's a rough night. It's a rough night at the movies.
Oh God.
It's really going to upset you by the end of that. You might quit movies by the end of that evening.
Yeah.
But I always admired and always considered Only God Forgives his Firewalk because it's an open rejection of the success mainstream wise that he had with Drive.
Yeah.
And also because he hated that people loved Drive and loved Drive for
they were
all.
Trying to box him in and
and he was like no, and so he made the ugliest, meanest, grossest movie where he even took his central star, his pretty boy, and beat the ever living fuck out of him. Like Ryan Gosling spends half that movie with his face bashed in, and Kristen Scott Thomas is basically like the Diane Ladd.
Yeah, he crawls back inside her guts. It's like crazy.
It's so good. I might watch that movie tonight. Yeah. I love that movie.
I haven't seen it. I only saw it once. I hated it when it first came out.
It's so gross.
Yeah.
I adore it. It's great. Nick Reffin, you're a fucking maniac. But it's also like, as we talked about in our extended Too Old to Die Young kind of podcast, it's like, it's him at his most like aggressively defiant, where it's like, you're not going to tell me what I am.
Exactly.
And that's exactly what, you know, Lynch did with Firewalk with Me, is that it's like, you're not going to take my baby away from me. I define what Twin Peaks is.
Yeah.
So instead of the remake question, or like the limited series question, because I mean we've had that answered with, you know, Twin Peaks: The Return with David Lynch. We're gonna ask, what current filmmaker would you like to see get their version, get to do basically their version of like Twin Peaks or The Return, like their defining like series? Because we're in the kind of era of prestige television and everything and people giving auteurs money to do this stuff. And I think it would be curious, who do you think could craft the next Twin Peaks?
I strangely think, I just have them on the mind, is the Coen brothers. I think that they have the imagination like Lynch to fill the time. Like you watch the way they write and it's just like, they could go on forever. You know, and so I think, and their ability to create these really unique, strange characters, and also the sense of it like kind of being a hyper realism. It's not quite.
Do you think they would do it after Fargo?
See, that's what I was thinking is one of the problems, is someone's already kind of done it with their work.
That's, you know, what I mean.
Yeah. Noah, and I love Noah Hawley, what he did with that.
We get the Alien series here.
I'm so fucking excited.
Did you see that trailer?
Oh, yeah.
For it?
Oh,
it looks so fucking
what a
good.
Great idea.
Yeah.
What a great, I mean, I'm just like, he's doing everything right. Like
here's a workplace drama, but it has a xenomorph.
Yep. Done. And Timothy Oliphant, I'm in.
It'd be great if Steve Carell in The Office was just replaced with a xenomorph. Or Jim. It's not even Jim or Steve Carell. It's like what if John Krasinski and Steve Carell remained, but like Rainn Wilson was replaced with the Xenomorph.
Yeah, there's a Predator over there too.
No Dwight.
But I mean, I think,
well, the Predator's Idris Elba. He's introduced in like season 5 or whatever.
I would say if Fargo the show didn't exist, and we could go back to like, what if like 1998 or you know, or like early 2000s. And they did like a 6-8 episode.
Or they did like a Cormac McCarthy adaptation as like a limited series, like a No Country type thing.
I just think that they're kind of their type of writing. And again, they're just like very fertile minds would be great for TV. Also, I just think similar to Lynch, they can really dance that line between very attractive for like the masses, but also kind of do their own stuff underneath it. You know, they're not obviously avant-garde at all, but playing with pulp, I think they'd be have a lot of fun with. And they kind of already did the weird thing with like Buster Scruggs, is things that are kind of TV, you know?
So, yeah, it was like, here, we have this idea for basically these short films. What if we smash them into an anthology movie for Netflix? The problem with that is that I don't think Buster Scruggs is that good.
No, agreed. But I'm saying they're open to, like,
they're open to fucking around with the format.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm going to go out on a limb with mine and do a director whose work you're actually more familiar with than me, but I think he would fit the mold. And he's done genre stuff before. He's done avant-garde stuff before. Not avant-garde, but like experimental stuff, we'll say. But what about Kiyoshi Kurosawa? If he was able to craft like a serialized mystery.
Oh, yeah.
Where he kind of came out of nowhere, played with the surreal stuff, but also introduced all the detective elements of, like, you know, Cure or Cloud.
Yeah. It would be no levity at all. It would be a dark.
Yeah.
Like, he's got a weird sense of humor. And our friend, obviously, Shapiro is a huge fan of his as well.
I mean, Park Chan-wook would be the other.
And he's done some great TV. You know,
never watched the thing that he did with Robert Downey Jr. because everybody said it wasn't that great.
Well, I'm thinking of the one he did. What's the Le Carre one he did?
Oh, Little Drummer Girl.
Yeah, like that was great.
I never watched it. Is it good?
Yeah, you'd love it. It's because
it's Florence Pugh and Michael Shannon and.
Who
is it? Sarsgaard?
It's Sarsgaard. Yeah. And it's great. I think, you know, someone from Korean cinema or Japanese cinema who does like.
I'm just trying to think something outside of the box.
Miike.
Jesus Christ. Did you see that he's doing Bad Lieutenant Tokyo?
Oh, yeah. I'm so into it. They're shooting it like right now, right?
Yeah. I mean, knowing the way that he works, it's probably done and edited already.
Yeah, he goes back in time and shoots it in the past. Like, he's so fast.
I mean, my rationale is this, is that it's like a guy or woman. We have to be, you know, gender-centric here.
Dude, what about Decker New?
Who?
Who did? Sorry. Pronounce it better. Titane.
Oh, Julia DeCarno.
DeCarno, yeah.
Ooh, DeCarno would be fun. But yeah, and she would be a little more outside the box. The thing is, it's almost like she's too abrasive.
Yeah.
Like there's less. And I'm really excited to see Alpha. But like, I don't know if that would work. But my whole rationale was just like a guy who makes movies that have like a genre hook like Lynch did, but and no huge like kind of mainstream success. Like, you know, Lynch had some Academy Award stuff and Blue Velvet was a hit and everything, but like Twin Peaks still became a phenomenon sort of out of nowhere.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to pick someone like that. So Kurosawa would be my go-to for it. Because also Kurosawa's never really had anything in the States, like at all, success-wise.
No. And Cloud also fucking ruled.
Oh, I haven't watched it yet.
Good shit.
Good? I have to watch it.
I watched it on a plane. It was awesome.
Good for you. So, final question. Face Melter. Yay, nay?
It's a tough one in terms of our normal kind of.
I'm just going to say it, yes.
Yeah.
100%. Just because I think it's it really was like an atom bomb on my brain as a kid. Like, I never saw movies the same way again. And, like, is it a face melter in the same way that, like, Hard Target is?
Yeah,
it,
actually, no. No, absolutely not. Yeah.
But it is, like, it rewires you mm-hmm. a bit. And, like, you're never really the same from that point forward. And I think that still counts as a face melter.
Well, and to your earlier point, he also is a person that, you know, creates these dream worlds that you sink into. And, like, even seeing that film so many times over the years, every time I rewatch it, it's just like I'm transfixed.
Right.
You know, you don't watch Lynch. This is movies, you know, you put on in the background. You see, I mean, I've seen
there's no passive watching.
I've seen
Lynch.
Halloween 300 times. I put it on the background. I'm on my phone.
So, yeah.
You know what I mean? But, like, Lynch, I don't do that. I can't do that.
No.
I have to give myself over. Like,
could you imagine
movie.
Watching Firewalk just in the background?
Oh, God.
Especially the last like 20 minutes of it is just pure screaming.
Yeah, you're trying to make quesadillas in your skillet, and you're like,
Yeah. This rape scene is really soothing. Well, Martin.
What a way to end.
Spy number 75 is in the books. And I guess we're going to let people know kind of going forward. This is sort of a revival for us. We're coming through on a promise to do a David Lynch episode. But going forward, we're going to try and take Secret Handshake back to being A, more regular, and B, a little more streamlined in terms of content, where we're going to go back to the original idea of doing one movie and not 50 in a single episode, to try and really churn out a few more for you guys so you hear our voices on a more regular basis. And we got a whole list of stuff that we really like. Coming up next, I think we're going to do some Ozploitation, finally.
Yes.
Which actually will be probably a bit more of a robust episode because I've been watching Ozploitation, it seems like, for the last, like, 9 years of my life to prepare for it. But also, B, we just saw Dangerous Animals.
Huh?
The new Sean Byrne movie with a completely deranged Jai Courtney performance
in
it.
And it's great.
And it's totally worth your time. And it's on Shudder now?
Not yet. Still is theaters.
Okay,
yeah.
We're still waiting for it. But when it does hit Shudder, holy shit, this movie's going to blow your fucking minds. But tune in next time for another Animals Attack movie down under. It's going to be Russell Mulcahy's Razorback.
I cannot wait.
Yeah, it's one of Martin's favorite movies, and you have to stay tuned to hear him jizz all over the microphone while he talks about killer pigs. So, bye. See you then.
See you then.
A candy-colored clown they call the Sandman tiptoes to my room every night, just to sprinkle stardust and to whisper, go to sleep, everything is all right. I close my eyes, then I drift away into the magic night. I softly say a silent prayer, like dreamers do. Then I fall asleep to dream. If I try.